You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Well, it's gone from the weird to the weirder. I got to tell you, yesterday it looked, well, first of all, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartmann, that's me. I'm here with you and pleased to be with you here from the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., just about three blocks from the nation's capital, actually, from where the goddess of liberty looks down on, you know, Columbia, looks down on her district. And because it's such a sacred place, people in the district don't even have the right to vote for, you know, they don't have senators. We don't have senators. And our representative does not have the right to vote in Congress. But anyway, yesterday it looked like the Republicans were taking it on the chin, that they were just going to get whacked upside the head because they were saying, nah, you know, in the House of Representatives, these are Republicans, the Tea Party Republicans, John Boehner and, you know, the head of the Republicans in the House, but not the head of the Tea Party Republicans. That's his number two guy, Eric Cantor, the guy who's, you know, Brutus in this play here where Caesar's going to end up saying et tu, Brute. Maybe he may not have to wait till the Ides of March. In any case, this is just incredible. Yesterday, well, the day before yesterday, the Senate passed this bill to extend just for 2 months, because they couldn't work out language for a whole year, unemployment benefits and the so-called working class tax cut. In other words, a cut in the Social Security tax that is paid for with other things. And in fact, I'm going to get into what it's paid for and all that kind of stuff. But anyhow, they could only, you know, they could agree on 2 months worth, but not a year's worth. So they did it in the Senate. And you've got five senators. I mean, Scott Brown, Olympia Snow, Susan Collins. You've got a bunch of these senators saying, come on, Republicans, into the House. Vote for the damn thing. Well, the Republicans in the House were not even willing to vote on it. Instead, they voted on a resolution about voting on it because they didn't want to go back. They didn't want to have campaign commercials saying, Joe Blow, the Republican from Tea Partyville, voted not to extend middle-class tax cuts, although he voted 27 times to extend tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, or however many times it may be. So it looked like the Republicans were just like losing this PR war. But I'm telling you, today, I think they're getting it back. And here's why. The Republicans said, okay, you know, we're in the House of Representatives. They said, you know, we're not going to vote for this two-month thing because it doesn't hurt people enough. So we're going to put on the table a one-year extension of this payroll tax cut and unemployment benefits, but we're going to cut unemployment benefits from 99 weeks back down to 59 weeks maximum. We're going to make people who get unemployment benefits take drug tests. If they're not high school graduates, they're going to have to enroll in a GED course, presumably at a for-profit college run by one of their campaign contributors. They're going to strip the Environmental Protection Agency of the authority to regulate toxic waste incinerators and other kinds of incinerators and boilers, power plants. This is an action that the EPA says will lead to an additional 20,000 deaths in the United States. This is what the Republicans want, right? It's like a grab bag of goodies. They want they don't just want the president to decide on the Keystone pipeline within 2 months. They want the damn thing in their year-long bill. And the, you know, of course, the State Department and the Interior Department have not yet even finished their scientific evaluation of this, which is code for how do we deal with the Republicans in Kansas who are opposed to this. And there's, you know, some science in here. They want to cut $8 billion out of Obamacare. All of this in exchange for the year-long extension, right? $8 billion bucks out of Medicare or out of Obamacare. They want to put in a provision that says that if you get any kind of money from the federal government in the form of these benefit transfer cards that people can use for, you know, the whether it's Social Security benefits or food stamps or whatever. Of course, you can't do this with food stamps anyway because they're already restricted. There's even certain kinds of food you can't buy with food stamps. But if you're getting, you know, if you're getting any kind of electronic benefits, you cannot use that money in an ATM machine, in a casino, in a liquor store, or most importantly, in a strip club. So take that, you unemployed person. And they want to create this giant big government bureaucracy, like I said, to drug test people. So you would think that the corporate media, the mainstream media, and even NPR would report on all this. That the Republicans are saying, yeah, we'll give you a year, but we want a pound of flesh, maybe 3 pounds. And, of course, even their own colleagues in the Senate, the Republicans in the Senate, would not vote for that because it was too crazy. They already tried that, and that's why they came up with this 2-month compromise that just forces the president to decide whether to decide on the Keystone Pipeline. But here's how NPR reported on it. This just blew my mind when I heard this morning. Listen to this.
NPR congressional reporter Tamara Keith explores the maneuvering.
Now, just pause that for a second, Jacob. Just tell me if you hear anything about all the demands the Republicans are making in this report. Go ahead.
Just in case you've been out buying presents or working or not watching C-SPAN with bated breath, here's an update on what happened yesterday. The House, specifically Republicans in the House, rejected a bill that had broad bipartisan support in the Senate. That bill was an interim measure. It would have extended jobless benefits and the payroll tax holiday for 2 months until a year-long deal could be worked out. Republicans said 2 months wasn't long enough. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor is a Virginia Republican.
Families, employers, and workers can't live their lives month to month. Washington needs to stop adding confusion and more uncertainty to people's lives.
Now, just pause it there, Jacob. That here's the new meme. The Republicans are coming along saying in the House, you know, if they can get the media to play along and not mention these poison pills that they put in this year-long bill, then what they're saying is, well, the reason we voted against the reason we refused to vote on the 2-month extension is because we want to give Americans a whole year. We're Santa Claus. We want to give them a whole year. Back to NPR, Jacob.
So Republicans voted to create a conference committee to hash out the differences between the House and the Senate. House Speaker John Boehner.
This is a system that our founders gave us. It's as old as our nation and as clear as the Constitution.
Okay, so, and then they go into, you know, the weirdness of conference committees and how they work and, you know, House and Senate and all this stuff. No mention of drug testing, no mention of you can't use your ATM in a strip club, no mention of cutting unemployment benefits from 99 weeks down to 59 weeks when most of the world lets you get them as long as the recession lasts. No, the new Republican meme picked up this morning by NPR and presumably by all the media. I mean, I haven't done a survey of all. I don't watch all the morning shows. I don't watch any of the morning shows. And this just happened to pop on when I woke up because there's no progressive station here in Washington, D.C. And what is it? Oh, the Republicans want to give you a year. The Democrats want to give you 2 months. They can't work it out, so they're going to try and have this conference committee between the House and the Senate to work out their differences. Are you kidding me? And this is the media that the right-wingers are saying this has a liberal bias? The Republicans might just win this media war.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, how long is this going to go on? And what, you know, what have you heard? What are you hearing out there in terms of the reporting? Are you hearing the whole Republicans say, oh, we want to give them a year? Now, this thing is so toxic. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. This thing is so toxic. Alex Seiswald over at Think Progress was talking about how today Mitt Romney, he was on a couple of different TV shows this morning and repeatedly asked, what do you think about this payroll tax extension payroll tax cut and extension of unemployment benefits, and, you know, the 2 months coming out of the Senate versus the 12 months coming out of the House. And again, none of the questioners asked about, you know, drug testing people to get unemployment benefits or cutting unemployment benefits from 99 weeks down to 59 weeks or, you know, all the other, this whole list of poison pills that I gave you a little bit before. Instead, they just asked these kind of, you know, what do you think? And Romney every single time said, oh, I don't know. He refused to take a position this morning, which he's very good at. But meanwhile, yesterday, John McCain basically, you know, was acknowledging that the Republicans were shooting themselves in the foot. And there was a lot of Democrats doing high fives last night. I was one of, I was one of them. We had a conversation, Eric Burns and I had a conversation about this last night on TV. But it's whether, but I, you know, I'm saying to myself now, not so fast. Here's what John McCain was saying yesterday.
It is harming the Republican Party. It is harming the view, if it's possible, anymore, of the American people about Congress. And we got to get this thing resolved and with the realization that the payroll tax cut must remain in effect.
Right. See, so the Senate and John, even John, you know, there was like this kind of broad consensus by the end of the day yesterday that if the House doesn't vote for the Senate bill, that they've shot themselves in the foot. Now, John Boehner thought he'd worked this thing out. He'd worked it out with Mitch McConnell, you know, Mr. Turtle, the guy who's the head Republican over in the Senate, who's a very, very, very powerful man and a very sly negotiator. I mean, he didn't get to be the most powerful Republican in the United States Senate, the most powerful of the two legislative bodies. He didn't get to that position without climbing over some people and stepping on some heads and, you know, the drill. So he had this thing worked out with Boehner, and Boehner thought, fine, you know, we'll pass it in the House. We'll go home. Christmas will come. Everything's great. And by the way, happy second day of Hanukkah today to those of you who are observing, practicing, or having a good time. And in any case, you know, they thought, okay, that's it. We're going to, you know, we'll adjourn for the holidays. And no. Overnight, I'm guessing they met with Frank Luntz. Or maybe it didn't even take Frank Luntz. I mean, this isn't rocket science. I don't know why I didn't see this yesterday and predict this. That all the Republicans have to do, given the fact that the media are stenographers, that they don't tell you what's really going on. They don't tell you the news behind the news. They don't say that, you know, the Republicans' year-long plan in the House of Representatives creates a giant new big government intrusion in your lives that you got to pee in a cup in order to get unemployment benefits every week. If you didn't graduate from high school, you've got to go to some high school that probably is owned by Jeb Bush's brother. He in the education industry. Remember, Barbara Bush would only donate money to her son's education program for Katrina. That they're going to strip the EPA of the authority to regulate power plants and incinerators, and 20,000 people will die, according to the EPA. That they're going to cut the amount of time that people can be on unemployment from 99 weeks down to 59 weeks. None of the press that I saw this morning, or I heard this morning, which frankly was just one network and on the radio and one on TV. I didn't have that much time doing show prep and I'm, you know, reading and everything else. But and none of it that I saw reported any of this stuff. Instead, what they're doing is they've come up, you know, the Republicans have come up with this message. We want to give people a year. The Democrats over in the Senate only want to give people 2 months. There's a few Republicans that they kind of suckered into it because, hey, it's the end of the year. And Scott Brown's picking on us because he's afraid of Elizabeth Warren, who's a super liberal in Massachusetts, a liberal state. By the way, did I tell you Mitt Romney's from Massachusetts? This gets back to the internecine warfare in the Republican Party. But basically, they're saying, I mean, this is the Republican message. Come on, guys, we want to give you a year. The Democrats only want to give you 2 months. So we're going to go home for Christmas, and we're going to let the Democrats over in the Senate agree with us. And if you think the Democrats in the Senate are going to say, yeah, we're going to go along with cutting the amount of time somebody can be on unemployment from 99 weeks down to 59 weeks, and saying that somebody has to be drug tested to get them. Oh, and they're going to means test Medicare. This is part of the House plan. If you're on Medicare and you earn over $1 million a year, you can't get Medicare or unemployment benefits, excuse me. You can't get unemployment benefits. I think they were going to means test Medicare as well. Well, what this does, I mean, this is the camel's nose under the tent. This is basically, this is the process by which insurance programs, so-called entitlement programs, programs that we all participate in and we all benefit from, whether we are making $15,000 a year or we are making $15 billion a year, doesn't matter. We are all in it together. This is the we society stuff, that these programs are going to be converted into welfare programs. That's what means testing does. Now, they always start out high. Let's just exclude the millionaires. Then a couple years down the road, hey, let's exclude everybody making over $200,000 a year. And then a couple years down the road, hey, let's exclude everybody making over $50,000 a year. And then a couple of years down the road, hey, let's only make this available to people making $20,000 a year or less. And then, because they know that people who make $20,000 a year or less, by and large, don't vote so much, because they're, you know, they can't get time off from work and our elections are on Tuesdays. Then they say, hey, let's just do away with the program. That's what the Republicans are up to. Your calls next and your thoughts on this. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Are we going to hear from our media anything other than the it's the year versus the 2 months? Are we going to hear the truth? Turn your radio up, everybody around. Yeah, we'll clap you right in the left venue and sound. Bring it off, don't need for aggravation. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. Only slightly unbalanced. Actually, I think that we're doing some of the most balanced media out there. It's like, I'm telling you the actual story of what happened in the House of Representatives yesterday, and I wasn't hearing that this morning on network television. I wasn't hearing it this morning on NPR, as I shared with you. And I think that the NPR thing, I think that this is the, I think it's the Stockholm Syndrome. I think it's the exact same reason why the PolitiFact lied about the biggest lie of the year. They said Paul Ryan did not, you know, and all the Republicans did not vote to end Medicare as we know it. They just wanted to turn it into a voucher program that would eventually die. It's like, okay, I've got this can of Coke here, and if I pour out the Coke and I fill it full of milk and I hold it up in front of you and I say, hey, look at the label says Coke. This is a can of Coke. Right. Brilliant. Mark in Calabasas. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind?
Good morning, Tom. Apropos of what you were talking about, and since you said NPR, I heard Congressman David Dreyer from California, Republican, just Monday night say when he was being interviewed that the provision about the Keystone Pipeline in the Senate's version asking or requiring Obama to make a decision within 60 days was not the language the Republicans in the House wanted, but in fact they wanted Obama to have to make a decision yes for the pipeline within 60 days.
That's right.
That was part of their package.
That's right.
And that's
right.
Astounding to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, the right. Thank you, Mark. Well said. The Republican bill is full of poison pills. I've got this list of 10 of them here that I'm not going to go through it again, at least not right now. I will in a little bit. But let's pick up some more of your some more of your thoughts. Will in Blakesley, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'm really glad that you talk about NPR because you're one of the few people, I don't know if the media people that I know that really does that. I've noticed this for a couple of years, actually. They're drinking more and more of the GOP Kool-Aid, and that's I stopped listening to them. And I think what the Democrats need to do, they need to come out and loudly say publicly, okay, NPR, the next time the Republicans go, you know, set out to destroy you, you're on your own. We're not going to.
Well, they're largely on their own anyway. You know, the fact of the matter is that NPR is doing very well. Thank you very much. They're only 7% of their budget is coming from the federal government. The individual stations are making good money. They've got bureaus around the world. They produce a good product. I mean, they've got, you know, high quality production values. There is some truth to Rush Limbaugh's old statement that liberals listen to NPR and instead of progressive talk radio and blah, 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 at least during morning and afternoon drive. You know, they've got a couple of good programs there. But, you know, I think it's tragic. And this goes back to I think it was during the Reagan administration that NPR did that investigate. They used to do a lot of good investigative journalism, and they busted Archer's Daniel Midland for price fixing. And ADM got this $300 million fine, biggest in history for, you know, one of the big ag companies. And all of a sudden, guess who is sponsoring NPR? Supermarket of the World, ADM. Right? And yeah. And guess who is no longer doing investigative reporting? So yeah, I just, you know, Greg Palast calls them National Petroleum Radio because they won't report on what's going on with the oil companies.
Yeah, and NPR is really, I mean, Sirius is, you know, is great. It's growing, and obviously, you know, free speech TV, and there are some pockets on AM radio, for example, that have, you know, progressive shows like yours. But the reality is on easily accessible radio, NPR is really the only thing that remotely comes to anything that's not right wing. Yeah. And once that goes, and it's going, they've got it's 100% lock at this point. I mean,
yeah,
for free.
Well, and you're seeing the same thing with network news. You know, they have been working the refs, as Lee Atwater used to say back during the Reagan administration. They have been working the refs. In fact, he started saying that back in the 70s. They have been working the refs being the media, the right-wingers, through the Cato Institute, through the Heritage Foundation, through the American Enterprise Institute, through the scream machines, through the, you know, all these guys with their manufactured outrage and you know, faux populism and whatnot. They have been working them so hard that they've got the corporate media and the NPR media, basically the mainstream media, the majority of the media in this country, cowed. They've got them terrified. They're in a corner. They're afraid. And they even have PolitiFact. The last 3 years in a row, the biggest lies were told by Republicans. And so PolitiFact identified them as the biggest lies of the year. Well, they have gotten so much crap for doing that this year they said that the biggest lie of the year was the Democrats saying that Paul Ryan's bill to end Medicare was a bill to end Medicare. And in fact, it wasn't even the Democrats who said that. It was the Wall Street Journal who said that. The Democrats quoted the Wall Street Journal in an ad. PolitiFact didn't even get their damn facts right when they lied about the situation. You know, it's like everybody's afraid of the Republican Party. I'm not afraid of the Republican Party. I'm going to tell the truth on this show. Will, thank you for the call. Dave in Long Beach, California. Hey, Dave, what's up? Thanks for listening to KTLK.
Thanks, Tom. By the way, it's nice, polite Republicans.
Say it again?
It's nice, polite Republicans.
Nice, polite Republicans? What do you mean?
That's what NPR stands for.
Oh, NPR. Okay, I didn't get the acronym. Got it. Okay. Nice, polite Republicans. Yeah.
That's not me. That's a blogger says it. But it seems to me kind of funny. The Republican line is leaning heavily on this, the idea of a Congress committee. They keep on, they really emphasize that every speaker who brings it up, you know, like brings up this that they want their the year extension. Talked about having a Congress committee, but they don't have a bill, do they?
Well, the Republicans have a bill. I don't know if they passed it. They passed a resolution yesterday, which is not a bill.
You can't have a Congress committee if you don't have a bill passed, right? That's what a Congress committee is. To reconcile two pieces
of legislation. Good point. And that might be why Nancy Pelosi is refusing to appoint conferees. That's an excellent point. I frankly don't know, and I'm going to have to find out. Thank you very much for that, Dave. By the way, I didn't mean that as a gratuitous attack on NPR. What my point was that when NPR is drinking the Kool-Aid, everybody's drinking the Kool-Aid. And the Kool-Aid, which means that the Republicans are winning the messaging war, and they're doing so by saying, oh, we want to give people a year. Please don't notice the fact that we're giving people a year with our right hand, and with our left hand, we're cutting 99 weeks down to 59 weeks. We're going to make everybody pee in the cup. We're creating all these big government programs. We're, we're going to kill 20,000 people by cutting back on EPA regulations, which is, you know, the Koch brothers' wet dream, all these other things. They're not talking about that. Robert in Meridian, Texas. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Yes, I wanted to ask about the two-week thing. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm on. If you could take it off speakerphone, it'd be great. But, yeah, you're on the air, Robert.
Okay. What I wanted to ask, this two-week thing, when it first came about...
2 months.
Which was, 2 months ago, you know, did this happen, you know what I'm saying, a week ago? We'll just have to make it 2 weeks. Or did they say... we'll make it a year, and they said, no. When did it start about? I don't know if Bernie can answer my question. And if you get my
as to who started what, when, and how the process went, and how that sausage got made in the United States Senate, I know that they've been working on this for weeks. I don't know the details of the progression. I can't give you that. That would be a good question to ask Bernie. And Bernie's going to be on today's Wednesday, right? Tomorrow, Bernie's going to be on tomorrow. We're going to do brunch with Bernie a week. Or a day early, so he'll be on tomorrow, so we'll check that out with him, and we'll see what happens. Chris in Oakland. Hey Chris, what's up?
Hey Tom, thanks for taking my call. How you doing?
Great, thanks for listening to Green 960.
Hey, thanks for being on.
Yeah,
you've cited the statistic yourself that the Congress is, the approval rating is just abysmal.
11%. Never been that low in history.
Right, that's what Eddie said last night. I mean, people are getting it. I think people are figuring it out. You know, and there's an argument that it's the whole kit and caboodle people are going to be angry at and they're going to associate. I think people are seeing a little bit of the difference, regardless of how the messaging is going. If this keeps up at this rate, I think, you know, it's my opinion, my humble opinion, that the House might flip pretty easily.
I think so,
November.
Too. I think that there
my
is
question,
a... Go ahead.
I'm sorry. My question to you is... because you follow this stuff pretty closely, and I think you're pretty brilliant. How safe do you think Boehner and Cantor are in their actual seats?
How what?
And I have a follow-up question, too. How safe do you think...
Oh, how safe are they? Oh, there's actually a Democratic challenger. Eric Cantor's in a totally safe seat. He's in a part of Virginia where... most of the people who live there are like, you know, rich Republicans living in very wealthy, in very big houses, and they make their money in the defense industry. So there's no way they're going to elect anybody other than a Republican, and Eric Cantor is like a totally safe seat. John Boehner, on the other hand, there is a Democrat who is running in the primary to run against Boehner who is outpolling him or equal to him right now. So there's a very good chance that John Boehner himself could be in trouble. The same thing with Paul Ryan. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see.
And one more question. When are you coming back to the Bay Area? We got to get back on the Hornblower.
Yeah, I agree. It would be great to do another cruise out there. I don't have specific plans. We're working out something right now for Seattle, but maybe we can do a few other things on the West Coast. But you know, time will tell. Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. And we're out of time. What's that voice? The machine just croaked. By the way, this headline from the BBC News says it all. Not to change topics, because I'm going to come back to this. You know, are the Republicans winning the message war? But just get this headline. This is BBC. You won't see this in the New York Times. Homeless people die 30 years younger, study suggests. That's pretty mean.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And how many homeless children do we have in the United States? 1.6 million. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, Boehner just cut the mic. No, I'm not kidding. I'm not making this up. John Boehner, they just moments ago in the House of Representatives, you had the guy who was serving as the Speaker pro tem, in other words, the filling in for the Speaker of the House of Representatives, who was the Congressman Representative Michael Fitzpatrick, the Republican from Pennsylvania. He says, "Okay, that's it. We're out of here. You know, I'm adjourning the House." And Steny Hoyer is still trying to talk, and he's saying, "Wait a minute. We want to have a vote. on whether or not we should extend the tax cut for working Americans and unemployment benefits for working Americans, and whether we should, you know, they got to fix this thing with Medicare so that the doctors don't take like a 27% pay cut or something like that. So, you know, we got to make sure that the people get the, you know, their Medicare paid for. And you'll hear about a minute of him going on about this. And then all of a sudden, this is the live C-SPAN feed. All of a sudden, it gets cut off. And when it gets cut off, you just go to a frozen picture of the House of Representatives. And the folks over at Think Progress contacted C-SPAN, and they said, how come you cut this guy off? And the C-SPAN people said, we don't control the microphone. The Speaker of the House does. That would be John Boehner. Listen to this.
Pursuant to Section 3B of House Resolution 493, the House stands adjourned until 10 a.m. on Friday,
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Speaker, I would like to ask for unanimous consent that we bring up the bill to extend the tax cut for 160 million Americans. As you walk off the floor, Mr. Speaker, you're walking out, you're walking away, just as so many Republicans have walked away from middle-class taxpayers, the unemployed, and very frankly as well from those who will be seeking medical assistance from their doctors, 48 million senior citizens. We regret, Mr. Speaker, that you have walked off the platform without addressing the issue of critical importance to this country, and that is the continuation of the middle-class tax cut, the continuation of unemployment benefits for those at risk of losing them, and the continuation of the access to doctors for all those 48 million seniors who rely on them daily for their health. And I am pleased to yield to my friend, Mr. Van Hollen.
Well, thank you, Mr.
And then all of a sudden, it's gone. And Mr. Van Hollen cannot be heard because Mr. Boehner has apparently said to C-SPAN, sorry, we're not going to provide you with any more audio. And, in fact, even the video just kind of froze up. It's pretty amazing. Gary in Corydon, Iowa. Hey, Gary, what's up?
It's Indiana, but that's...
Oh, Indiana. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was going to tell you, I'm not so sure that this whole thing is going to be a problem for Democrats, because there's a whole group of people from all different ages that have breakfast, and I, you know, about half of them are Republican, and even they were just absolutely completely blown away that the Republicans were doing this. You know, these are people who are diehard Republicans, and they are not going to vote for, you know, our Republican representative here. And they're even talking about not voting, you know, voting for the Republican senators.
Yeah.
So,
but wait until you've had a week of right-wing talk radio on hundreds of outlets across the United, close to 1,000 outlets across the United States.
Well, that may be true.
Tens of thousands of hours of it, and the media going along with the idea that, you know, the bumper sticker idea, they're trying to reduce everything to the simplicity of, well, you know, the Republicans in the House want to give people a year, and the Democrats in the Senate only want to give them 2 months. So why don't they just work these things out?
Well, I mean, I think they failed to take into account that there was 89 people in the Senate that voted.
89 votes, yeah. And about 30 of those were Republicans, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, more than 30 of them. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And Scott Brown has come out and called out his own party. Of course, he is running scared from Elizabeth Warren. But see, all that's being forgotten.
He's not the only one.
Yeah, no, he's not the only one. Elizabeth Snow said, you know, spoke out, and Susan Collins, the senators from Maine, and there were two others. I forget who they are.
Kane is one of them.
Kane, yeah, you're right. So okay. A little more obscure, but you know, they're speaking out. Gary, we'll see. We'll see. Forgive me for being cynical. I'm usually an incredible optimist, but when it comes to Republicans' messaging and the media rolling over, we'll see. Gary, thank you for the call. Time will tell. Time will really be telling. You know. Anyhow, Doug in Grays Harbor. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Yeah, morning, Tom. Say, happy solstice from the Wichita Valley here.
Well, thank you. Happy solstice to you, too.
Yeah, anyway, as far as those poison pills you're talking about earlier, very little being heard out here, at least from what I've been hearing. It's all been boiled down to Democrats wanted 2 months, but look, the cons are going to give you a year.
Right.
That's how it's boiled
down. So that's what you're getting from the local media there in Washington State.
Well, that's what I'd heard yesterday, as of yesterday anyway, you know, and
right.
You know, of course, you know, logic, you go and hold it. What about all this other stuff we heard last week or whatever that's never being mentioned.
Yeah.
So the next thing is, okay, 0.08 is the legal alcohol limit here in the state. I want my representative then. If they want me to piss in a cup, I want them to be on that floor of the Congress sober.
Every time they vote.
What's good for the goose is good for the gander.
You know, John Boehner would no longer be able to, would no longer be able to be in Congress.
No, I know, but you know, I mean, okay, let's come on, folks. We're all in this together. And anyway, Tom, I appreciate you being out there, and your voice is wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Sean in Battleground. Hey, Sean, we got 30 seconds. It's all yours.
Hey, Tom. You know, one faction of the Tea Party is the I am John Galt crowd, the libertarian
sure.
types.
Yeah.
And I heard this right wing libertarian the other night out of Las Vegas named Wayne Allen Root. I swear to God, he said that we should be nice to rich people because they are the financial first responders.
Yes,
basically,
Wayne. Go ahead.
Comparing himself to the first responders in 9/11, saying rich people are the financial first responders, so we need to be very nice to all the rich people.
Yes, Wayne has been on this show a number of times. We've had a lot of debates. He's I think he was the libertarian vice presidential candidate, or maybe the presidential candidate last time around, or something like that.
You know, since when did immodesty and grandiosity become American values, Tom? I mean, I always thought conspicuous consumption that was like tacky and tasteless and un-American.
Well, to give an actual honest answer to your presumably rhetorical question, Dean or Sean, is it Sean? Sean, yeah. They became American values with the Reagan administration. And just look at his inaugural ball. That was, you know, the contrast to Jimmy Carter.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We have been talking for the last hour about the 10 major poison pills. There's actually even a few more in the GOP payroll tax extension. They want to extend the payroll tax for a year, but cut the number of weeks you can get it from 99 down to 59, make you pee in a cup. It means test Social Security or, excuse me, Medicare, blah, blah, blah. There's a whole long list. I'm going to get back to that and how the media... Even NPR is buying into this. I mean, it's just astounding. But that said, there are other issues that America's facing as well. And one of them right now is the fact that trillions, that's with a T, trillions of dollars worth of assets in this country, principally land and buildings, are owned by churches that pay no property taxes. They get the benefits of fire departments, police departments, educated workforce, public roads, all that kind of stuff. They do not pay for it. And some of these organizations are making millions. Pat Robertson is worth $1 billion with a B, $1 billion. It's mind-boggling how much money some of these people are making. And they're making it in large part because they pay no taxes on their income, on their property, on pretty much anything. Should we be doing this? Is the separation of church and state enhanced by saying we're not going to impose state taxes on churches? Or is it diminished when if I give a $1,000 donation to a church, I can take that off my taxes, which means that's money that doesn't go to the federal government to do some other things that might be good things. How does that work? At what point? Where do we draw the lines? Carol Swain is with us. She's a professor of political science and law at Vanderbilt University, the author of the book Be the People, A Call to Reclaim America's Faith and Promise. Her website, carolswain.net. Carol, welcome back to the program.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. I'm pretty much on the record on this, that I'm fully supportive of absolute tax deductions for people who want to live monastically. If people take a vow of poverty, if they actually do what Jesus did, if they actually do what Buddha did, if they actually do, you know, if they have no means of support and they're not seeking any and they're not, you know, running a ministry where you can buy a prayer cloth or a Bible or a tchotchke for your wall or whatever, if they're living monastically, then I think that that is actually I honor that, and I think that there's a benefit to society in that. And I'm willing to pay their share of their property taxes. But for all these other, for everything else, where, you know, everybody, they want to pitch their belief system, I got a problem with it. What about you?
Well, first of all, I've been a regular church goer for about 12 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I tithe to my church, meaning I give about 10% of my income. And so I am in a position to see what churches do. And I think it varies a lot as far as how financially responsible different ministries are. The churches that I'm familiar with, the ones that I give to, are doing a lot of good in the communities. They're not duplicating what social services do. And I feel that the resources I give to the ministry are well used, and that the church is doing Jesus ministry.
But here, I've run businesses for 30 plus years, and this radio show is a business. And at the end of the year, you know, I was just talking with a couple of the people who work here a couple of days ago, and saying, you know, we're coming up on the end of the year. There's a little bit of money left in the checking account. Is there any equipment that we need to buy that we've been postponing? Because if we can use up all our money, we don't pay income taxes on it, right? There's nothing left over. Businesses do that. I mean, every business in America right now is doing that. They're looking at how they can get every small business anyway, how they can get whatever cash they have left over down to zero so that they don't pay income tax, or they pay very little income tax on it, because they don't make much money to begin with, and you got to buy stuff, you know. So, okay, now's the time to buy a new copy machine. Churches, if they're doing good works, and they were no longer tax-exempt entities with regard to income tax, all they have to do is make sure that at the end of their fiscal year, which could be any month of the year, that they actually zero out, just like most small businesses do.
Well, I think churches should be held accountable, and I believe it's a disgrace for churches that are huge, they run like businesses, not to pay, if they don't pay Social Security taxes, insurance, and unemployment benefits for their employees.
Well, we agree on that.
Heartless.
We agree on that, but I'm taking it a step further. I'm saying that I think that unless it's a monastery, that they should be paying property taxes, because they are benefiting from all the expenses of the local community that is providing it to them, you know, of fire and police and roads and all that kind of thing. They should be paying property taxes, which is what those things pay for, and they should be paying income taxes if they have income producing activities. And you and I both know some of these churches, you know, something on the order of over 100 ministries in the United States that generate over $10 million a year in revenue.
I think a distinction should be made between the mega churches that are huge business enterprises and those mom and pop inner city churches, the smaller ones with congregations of less than 1,000. And everything needs to be revisited.
Yeah.
We do have to make sure that we are holding people accountable. And I think it's good for the ministries to be held accountable financially, as well as for the congregations and for the society as a whole.
Well, I don't altogether disagree with the philosophy of that. I think that in a lot of communities, you've got churches that are doing good stuff, and they're small churches, and I've attended many of them over the years. And, you know, where you've got a congregation of 50 people or 150 people and they don't have a lot of money. And, you know, every penny is used well. And they're doing good local stuff. On the other hand, if they're in a poor area, if they're in a low income area, their property taxes aren't going to be much anyway. And if they're actually spending all their money on what they're doing, they're not going to be paying any income tax, so those kind of changes wouldn't hurt them significantly.
This would not bother me in isolation, but I feel that there is an attack on religion nationally, especially Christianity. And so when people talk about taxing churches, I see this as part of a broader attack. At the same time, I'm not happy at all with the churches in America, with religion in America. I think they've lost their focus, and that we need to bring everything back into right alignment, and some accountability would not be a bad thing.
Yeah, we had a guy on a week or so ago from, I think it was the American Family Council, might have been another group, who was all upset that businesses were not saying Merry Christmas. And I'm like, that is, you know, you're advocating blasphemy. I mean, you want You're upset because companies are not, you know, hustling Jesus to make money. You know, I find, as a Christian, I find that offensive. But
it bothers me when Christmas parties are removed because one person objects and they come up with all kinds of exotic names to call the holidays.
Right.
Rather than Christmas, in places where it's always been a tradition.
Well, but we have on that point. I mean, you know, tomorrow is the solstice, and that's where the Christmas tree originated. Was, you know, thousands of years ago.
I agree. I know all of this. I have a problem with some of it.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, that's very interesting. I appreciate your nuanced perspective on this, Carol, and I think that. There are a number of issues that have turned into bumper stickers that we need to have conversations about. This is one. I think abortion is another one. There are several that taxation of the rich, you know, very high income tax rates that just are untouchable in America. And I appreciate your coming on and having and starting this conversation with me. Carol Swain, CarolSwain.net, author of Be the People. Carol, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you very much. And we will be back. You know, what should we do with churches? And of course, it's not just churches. Churches, synagogues, mosques, whatever the Seventh-day Adventist people call, or the Mormons rather call them, temples, I guess.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Or, I don't know, it's wiveries? No, that's the other LDS group, isn't it? But anyway, what should we do? We'll be back.
If I thought we'd get a church on Sunday.
It's the media, your media support group for We the People. Tom Hartman here with you. And every year during the holiday season, you know, up until the end of the year, for just a few days, in this case it's 3 days this week, 4 days next week, we're mentioning and trying to raise funds for, and so far doing so, people have been responding, and thank you very much to the people who responded yesterday and Monday. We're trying to raise $20,000 for the Hunter School up in Rumney, New Hampshire. You can go visit them and see what they're doing. It's extraordinary work. Louise and I spent Thanksgiving up there. And it's a program that my wife Louise and I started in 1978, along with a bunch of really great people. And it's still running and doing very, very well. Residential school for kids with Asperger's, ADHD, you know, really some serious problems that make it hard for them to function. With any contribution over $250, and you can contribute online at hunterschool.org or salemchildrensvillage.org, either one of them. The two organizations operate essentially as one nowadays. They used to be separate, but we've kind of organized them together. And Hunter School or Salem Children's Village, both.org. You can either make a donation by PayPal, or there's a postal address if you prefer just mailing a check in. And for any contribution, the publisher, Barrett Kohler, of my most recent book, The Tom Hartman Reader, donated a bunch of copies of The Tom Hartman Reader to us, and I'm sending autographed plates to them. And so for every contribution over $250, we're sending a copy of The Tom Hartman Reader, along with the receipt and the thank you note. I just wanted to share a letter from Renee, one of the parents of one of the kids in Hunter School, so you can get a sense of what goes on there. Because this is just an extraordinary program. There are so few. Frankly, I know of no other program in the United States that works with these kids, these Asperger kids, these ADHD kids, these kids who are having, in many cases, severe problems with violent behavior, or those kinds of challenges, and doesn't drug them or call them defective. We refer to the ADHD kids as hunters in a farmer's world, right? They're always scanning their environment. They'd make great hunters if they were Aboriginal people, but they'd make lousy farmers. They couldn't, you know, pick the bugs off the plants for hours and hours and hours all day long. And we refer to the Asperger's kids as energetically sensitive. Actually, all of them, energetically sensitive. They're super sensitive, the energies around them, and they overreact. And Hunter School teaches them how to react appropriately and does it in a loving and educational way, rather than the more conventional, you know, behavioral modification, all that kind of nonsense. So this is a letter from Renee. She says, with the holiday season approaching, I want to take a moment and tell you how grateful I am for having you all in our lives. And I'm sharing this letter with her permission. She says, I'm so grateful for the success. I'm not going to name her son, but my son earns every day at the Hunter School with all your guidance and support. By the way, the school is for both boys and girls. She says they're in separate houses, but she says, for the first time, I am hopeful about him having a bright academic and social future. For the first time. Can you imagine being a parent? The Hunter School has shown him that he can be successful in reading, writing, and math. In 1 year, he gained almost 2 years in skills, followed by 3 exclamation points. And just as important, that he can be successful in relationships. As a special education teacher, this is the parent of one of our kids, I know that the road ahead for any child with ADHD, Asperger's, and behavioral challenges is not an easy road. I watched heartbroken as my son struggled in the public school setting. The failure after failure took a huge toll on my son. But at the Hunter School, he's learning the skills and tools he needs to survive and to be successful in the world. I have a son now who comes home from school excited about learning and smiling about his days. Even his worst days now are better than his days before attending the Hunter School. You all have special powers in my book. Hunter School superheroes. My son adores you all. Thank you for the gifts you have given to my son and for showing him that he can earn success in school just like any other child. The willingness you all have to help children like him reach new positive goals is beautiful. He now has a sense of meaning and purpose that he learned from the love and care you all invest in the children. During the past year, his soul and my soul have healed greatly because of the gifts from the Hunter School. Thank you with lots of love and white light, Renee and her son's name. And this is an actual letter from one of the parents. And so please, in this holiday season, if you have a little left over at the end of the year, it is a 501c3 tax deductible, and it's not a church, tax deductible organization. But, you know, whatever it is, whatever you can afford is much appreciated, whether it's $10 or whether it's, you know, more. In the past, we have had people make some substantial gifts. So far, not this year, but that would be great. We're trying to raise $20,000. Anything over $250, I'll send you, or Hunter School will send you a copy of my book, donated by the publisher, the Tom Hartman Reader, my newest book, that carries in it an article, a chapter about how we started this program and why, and some of the other adventures that I've had around the world with other programs that are affiliated with us. And you know, you'll get that along with a receipt and a thank you. And you can, like I said, the websites are hunterschool.org and salemchildrensvillage.org. And your contribution of whatever you can afford is much appreciated. And with $250, we'll send you a book autographed by me but you can read about the program. And in fact, they're even doing some workshops coming up. There's that information about the workshops that are coming up in Los Angeles and a few other cities about how to work with these kids is also over at the website at hunterschool.org as well. So you can check that out. So, and that came out of Lori, who co-runs the program with Jim. Her experience with her own son Zach, who was so violent that she was afraid of him, and who is just doing great now. He was on Oprah.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back. Let's get back to politics here and what's going on in the world, the news of the day, right after this, 27 minutes past the hour. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I just find this amazing. What was it? Yesterday, the day before, 3 days ago? Anyhow, sometime in the last couple of days, Louise, my wife and the executive, well, Sean's title is executive producer of the show, but Sean and Louise collaborate on making this show work, and Louise puts an enormous amount of work into it every day. And she made the comment to me that why don't the Democrats start calling this the Tea Party tax increase? And so I, you know, used that on the air a few times And she's like, this is the ultimate meme. And I'm like, you are so right. You know, this is just such a great meme. And guess what? MoveOn.org just sent out an email to everybody in Republican districts saying, why don't you call your Republican member of Congress and tell them to stop the Tea Party tax increase? Yeah, good one. What the media will not tell you is that the year-long extension that the Republicans say that they are generously offering in the House of Representatives, although they will not take a vote on it, but they're generously offering, will prevent the State Department from finishing their examination of the XL pipeline and simply say to the president, you have to say yes or no now. Presumably, yes, basically. In fact, not even presumably. It will mandate its construction. So they're overriding the president. They're forcing the XL pipeline, number one. They're going to let states bar people from collecting unemployment benefits unless they submit to drug testing. This is the party of small government, but they want the government to have its hand in front of your privates, saying, okay, pee in the cup. Why? Because you're suspect. Why are you suspect? Because you're unemployed. I mean, the drug testing industry is a multi-billion-dollar industry. It's very profitable. It's like 5 cents worth of chemicals that they sell for $35 to a government agency that pays for it with our tax dollars and then says to somebody, okay, pee in the cup. And the people who run the business hire lobbyists. Excuse me. I don't know if that sneeze made it on the air or not, but woo. Okay, strip the EPA of authority to regulate incinerators and boilers. This list, by the way, is over at the Huffington Post, Republicans' payroll tax cut. Strip the EPA of authority to regulate incinerators and boilers, which the EPA says is going to cause 20,000 people to die. They're going to say that if you get benefits, like, you know, unemployment benefits or whatever, if you get it by ATM card, you can't use it in a strip club or a casino or a liquor store. These are the people who hate big government, right? But they want to make sure that you can't walk into a strip club or a casino or a liquor store. They want to extend the pay freeze for federal workers. They want to eliminate government benefits for millionaires, sounds good, but it's means testing. It's starting to turn entitlement programs, insurance programs, into welfare programs, so eventually they could destroy them. They want to deny unemployment insurance benefits to high school dropouts unless they sign up for these. I mean, you know, the education industry is huge right now. Another industry with huge lobbyists buying off lots of members of Congress. So you got to be in a GED program. And they want to permanently cut the number of weeks you can draw unemployment. And this is the most important part of the whole thing that I didn't hear in this report. I'm not hearing it reports anywhere. They want to cut the number of weeks that you can draw unemployment benefits from 99 weeks down to 59 weeks. And for that, they'll give you a year. They'll give us a year for those people who qualify. But, you know, if you're in the 59th week, good luck. Oh, and you didn't pee in the cup? Sorry. Oh, you don't have a high school diploma? Well, you gotta come up with some cash and give it to, Neil Bush. It's amazing. It's amazing. So, 866-97-THOM, our telephone number, Virginia in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Virginia, what's up?
Hi, I want to congratulate you on the Hunter School. I'm sure it's light years ahead of what the government's doing.
Well, thank you.
I've been doing research on the government for 30 years or more, and it's abominable what's happened there.
Well,
Howard Dean in Vermont, he's a psychiatrist, and he was governor. He also ran for president.
I think he was actually a family physician, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, anyway, he fixed their system,
yeah,
and reduced caseload by 70%, fixed the state budget so
yes,
it balanced.
Yeah, he did. He did a lot of very good stuff. Virginia, thank you very much for that. And let me say that, you know, I am a big supporter of public schools, and even though Hunter School is not one. And this is one of the things. The big problem we have with these voucher programs and the whole Republican thing of let's give people school choice is that the private schools are cherry picking the easy students and the really tough students get stuck in the public schools. Hunter School is dealing with the kids that even the public schools can't deal with, who have been bounced out of school after school after school, or who can't even attend school. So, you know, it's kind of the other end of the spectrum. But I'm all done talking about that for the day. I don't want to turn this the whole day into this. Ronald in La Plata, Maryland. Hey, Ronald, what's up? Ronald, you got to listen to your phone, not your TV or radio, whatever it is. Gene in Malta, Illinois. Hey, Gene, what's on your mind? Gene? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Hello.
Yeah. Hey. Hey, Gene,
hey,
what's up?
I'm the jailhouse lawyer who has so far avoided the jail part.
Okay. That's a good plan.
You may remember. But anyway, I got a couple of questions about churches and tax exemptions. One of the things, you get the physical infrastructure to try and keep off the rolls. That's fine. But at some point, someone has to decide whether you're a religion or not.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how that actually works, because that seems to kind of...
That decision is made by the Internal Revenue Service, and and they have criteria for determining whether you're a religion or not. And I'm with James Garfield. He was a Republican president, 1881, right. United States. He said, and I quote, "The divorce between church and state ought to be absolute. It ought to be so right. absolute that no church property anywhere in any state or in the nation should be exempt for equal taxation. For if you exempt the property of any church organization, to that extent you impose a tax upon the whole community." And here's Ben Franklin talking about, you know, for the churches, who is kind of notoriously, he was a deist. He was not a particularly religious guy. He said, "When a religion is good, I conceive it will support itself. And when it does not support itself, and God does not care to support it, so that its professors are obliged to call for the help of the civil power, in other words, the government, 'tis a sign, I apprehend, of it being a bad religion." So there you go. That was Ben Franklin from Poor Richard's Almanac in 1754. So, I'm with you, Gene. This is something that bears further discussion. Bernadette in Sullivan City, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bernadette, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's Sullivan County, Pennsylvania.
Sullivan County.
You've probably heard
apologies.
From some of us before here. I have a sort of a little lighthearted question here.
Mm-hmm.
In Sullivan County, we liberals are literally the 1%.
Okay.
But the same
you mean,
thing
you mean as in 1% of the population, not the richest 1%?
That's indeed. Yeah. Well,
okay.
1% of the ideology. It's sort of just
okay.
turned around
it.
From nationally. We don't comprise many. There aren't many of us here is what
okay.
I'm saying.
Okay, got it.
Yes, and so this evening, I need to attend a small Christmas party at which, as it's turned out, as who had to cancel, et cetera, there will be four of us 99%ers, and 20-some 1%ers.
Okay, you've reversed them now in the metaphor. So there'll be four liberals
I'm
and 20-some very wealthy conservatives.
That's exact. Well, maybe not necessarily wealthy. We are rural and we are,
okay.
et cetera.
Okay.
But
supporters
what is the best way for me to deport myself this evening to make it 2 hours a doable thing?
My
be a pleasant social person. I seriously mean this.
I understand, Bernadette, and it's something that I've been confronting, you know, for 9 years doing this show. When conservatives come on or when they call in, and we even, you know, have a separate line for them, 866-745-CONS if they want to call in. And unlike, you know, Limbaugh show where they have to, you have to lie to the call screener to get in if you're a liberal. But in any case, my take has always been that I start by reminding myself that the person I'm talking to is a human being just like I am, who, you know, who has many of the same fears and hopes and aspirations and everything else. I mean, maybe it's a little easier for me because my father was a Republican and a conservative, but not quite the toxic kind we have today, but, you know, he was a more of an Eisenhower Republican, but he and I used to, and particularly during the Vietnam War, we used to fight like cats and dogs, my dad and I, about politics. And we would sit and we would watch William F. Buckley's show, Firing Line, on public television, you know, together, and then we'd argue for the whole weekend. And we loved each other dearly. And I learned that it's possible to politically disagree with someone and ultimately even to disagree on religion. I didn't learn until my dad was diagnosed with mesothelioma, was told that he had 3 months to live, that he was an atheist. You know, he had always taken us to church. And you know, we could even argue about religion. And I still loved him, you know. So I think that the key to it all is finding the common humanity. And then if you can operate out of a place of common humanity, the discussions of politics and issues become much smaller in that context. Does that make sense?
Advice. I'm glad I called. I'm glad I waited. Merry Christmas to everybody at FSTV. You are a lifesaver to people who are in areas like we are and isolated.
Great. Thank you, Bernadette. Thank you so much for your call. Merry Christmas to you and happy Hanukkah to our Jewish friends and happy Yuletide to our pagan friends and whatever it may be. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour, we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on here in D.C. today. It should be entertaining and interesting. And more of your calls.
I'm trying to be somebody. I'm not trying to be somebody else.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you, and Victoria Jones is at the White House with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us, about Living in the 21st by Ellen Ratner and Anne Gaiman. And Victoria, I started out the show today by playing a clip that I heard on NPR this morning, where basically they portrayed what's going on in the House of Representatives as the House wants to extend these unemployment benefits for a year, but the Senate only wants to do it for 2 months. And now they're going to have to get together with a conference committee and work out their differences. And no discussion of, but the Republicans in the House want to cut it from 99 weeks down to 59 weeks, and they want to make it pee in a cup and all this other stuff. And it really concerns me that the media, that the Republicans' talking points might actually start, you know, they're catapulting the propaganda. Was that the phrase from Sarah Palin?
Yeah, that's very interesting. It's a poor reporting. I mean, when you get into some of the stories, people do report slightly better than that. And I was listening to NPR this morning, and I wasn't listening closely because I was working too hard. But that's very interesting because that's not really the story. This is not a he said, she said story, frankly.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Sometimes
that's
right. Stories are in
yeah,
Washington.
So what's going on?
Well, the latest in this story is that the president called House Speaker John Boehner and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid this morning. And those two leaders are actually trapped in a deadlock.
Yeah.
And the
he called them independently or made a conference call?
Independently.
Okay.
And he told Boehner that the short-term bipartisan compromise passed by almost the entire Senate is the only option to ensure that middle-class families aren't hit with a tax hike in 10 days and gives both sides the time needed to work out a full-year solution.
Right. And Boehner said?
Well, we were not told in the briefing, which I've just come from with Jay Carney, we were not told what Boehner said. However, Boehner's office has now apparently put out a reply, and Boehner apparently said that it can be done today, but he was referring to the one-year extension.
Yeah, I think that Boehner might have said something like, well, Mr. President, Eric, get away from my back. What's that in my back? Ouch! Eric!
Yes, I think there's quite a lot of that going on, actually.
I think so.
I think he's quite concerned. But anyway, Jay Carney then responded to that and said, no, there isn't time to do the one-year extension, and that's the whole point. That's why they're having the two-month extension now, so that the people will not lose their payroll tax, and that they will then be time to come back and do the 1 year. And he made the point that it is because there are all these extraneous things that Republicans are insisting be in that they have to negotiate about.
Right. Now, my understanding also is that the Republican one-year plan mandates the XL pipeline. It doesn't even give the president the choice of yes or no, like the 2 month one does. Or
well, that is what I heard yesterday that one Republican lawmaker said, but I've not been able to see anything in writing to confirm that. But I did hear a Republican lawmaker say that.
That was reported on Huffington Post this morning.
Right, and that was one of the things that they prefer about this. So that's obviously something that's going to have to be worked out.
Right. Yeah, because that's big bucks for the oil industry, and the oil industry is like
Absolutely.
You know, is the Koch brothers.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Also today, I don't know whether you've talked about this, but two representatives from Maryland who, of course, you've got Democrats and Republicans from the House who are still here despite the fact that Congress almost en masse has gone. The House did leave yesterday, but the Republican members who've been appointed to the non-existent conference committee are still here, and there are Democrats, members of the House of Representatives, who are still here. Because they're making the point every day that the House needs to pass the Senate bill. Anyway, Chris Van Hollen of Maryland and Steny Hoyer of Maryland tried to call for the House to pass the Senate bill. And Representative Mike Fitzpatrick was presiding over the pro forma session. So they had the Pledge of Allegiance. And he immediately, Fitzpatrick, closed the session and said the next pro forma would be on Friday. As he gaveled the session closed, House Minority Whip Steny Hoyer asked to be recognized to speak, but Fitzpatrick didn't recognize him. Hoyer loudly protested the move as Fitzpatrick walked out of the House.
Yeah, we played the audio on the show.
Did.
And I will play it again in the next hour because it's brilliant. And then C-SPAN went silent. And
yes.
When Center for American Progress contacted them and said, why did you cut the mic of Chris Van Hollen when Steny Hoyer handed it off to him, they said, we don't control the mic. The Speaker of the House does.
That's correct. They don't have control of the mic.
So Speaker Boehner apparently didn't want this going out over the airwaves.
Yeah, which is very interesting.
And it's why I'm going to play it again next hour. So
yeah,
what else is going on?
Well, it's a bit messy in Iraq at the moment, actually.
Mm-hmm.
In a nutshell, the Prime Minister had the vice, who's a Shiite, had the Sunni vice president arrested on terrorism charges.
Right.
So the Sunni vice president fled to the semi-autonomous region of Kurdistan, said the whole thing was a plot and was rubbish, and these two, by the way, are old enemies. So in Iraq, nothing's ever as it seems, so who knows if it's true.
Right.
So he's issued an arrest warrant and says that the Kurds have to extradite him, which they don't want to do.
Right.
And now he's gone beyond that, and he now says that if this guy's political party doesn't get back into parliament, and if talks don't work out, he will form a majority government that would effectively block the Sunnis out completely.
Which will probably cause the Sunni-controlled territories of Iraq to secede?
Well, it's very interesting you say that, because there have been noises made by Sunnis who are interested in forming semi-autonomous regions.
Right, because
under the Constitution they are allowed to do.
Right, I mean, under Saddam Hussein, the country was heavily integrated. People, the Sunnis and Shia, married each other. They,
right.
they were, in some cases, forced into each other's communities, in other cases, simply voluntarily did, because Saddam Hussein kept a real lid on the on that Sunni-Shia tension. He didn't want it happening. And, I mean, he was a Sunni leader of a majority Shia country.
Right.
But once we started the war, they started killing each other, and very quickly that society got segregated.
Right. So we're looking at something that could blow over or could turn into balkanization.
Yeah. Well, balkanization seems like the least violent of the options. We'll keep an eye on it. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Brought to you by Ellen Rotner's new book, Self-Empowerment.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So what's the latest scam that the largest corporations in America are using to screw the most powerless people in America, basically minimum wage workers, and even turn them into sub-minimum wage workers? This story is going to blow your mind. Dave Jamieson is with us. He is a reporter for the Huffington Post, huffingtonpost.com/Dave-Jamieson for, you know, all the information on it. And he is writing about this new trend in America. The new blue collar is his piece. Temporary work, lasting poverty in the American warehouses. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. This is, I remember reading Barbara Ehrenreich's first book, Nickeled and Dimed, and her, I forget the sequel, the title of it, but I read both of them. And they're like, you know, these kind of slice of life insights into the horrors of people who are just barely getting by kind of on the margins of society or trying to get back into the workplace. But this is, this goes beyond that. I mean, this is, Walmart is, I thought that Walmart was the nation's largest employer. Are they not?
They are. They're the world's largest private sector employer. And kind of what I try to convey in this piece is that they're actually, in a sense, larger than even the workers they have on their books, because when it comes to warehousing and what's known as the logistics industry, there's a huge workforce out there behind the scenes that's moving stuff for Walmart and other retailers who don't you know, technically work for Walmart.
Why would they want to, first of all, what's the logistics, what does that mean, logistics industry?
Yeah, the logistics industry, basically the way, you know, when we say logistics, we mean the movement of goods. And this is, you know, a huge industry that sprouted up in the last 20 or so years as kind of, as this sort of movement has changed.
Is this what we used to call trucking and warehousing?
Yeah, pretty much. Only now warehousing is kind of a misnomer, because we don't try to house the goods anymore. These companies want to move them as quickly as possible.
Just in time, the whole thing.
Yeah, so they're basically, you know, coming in one side of the warehouse and going right out the other onto the store.
Right. So in the logistics industry, there are these subcontractors. It seems to me like, you know, if I'm Walmart, why am I going to pay a third-party company and, you know, have to pay the salary of their CEO and pay their bookkeeper when I've got my own bookkeepers and pay their janitor service when I've got my own and all that? Why am I going to pay a third-party company to come in and do this stuff for me when this is really central to my business?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of advantages, some of them seen and some kind of hidden. The biggest is, you know, when it comes to employing people, you know, this is a way to kind of take workers, you know, off your books, so to speak. When it comes to what you're going to pay workers, the benefits you're going to give them, chipping into workers' comp and all that, you basically make that, you know, somebody else's problem for a nominal price. And you know, with Walmart, they'll contract a company, in some cases called Schneider Logistics, who will contract to agencies below them, who will contract to agencies beneath them. So you have this really long line of contracting. And there are all kind of kinds of other ancillary benefits. I mean, one is sort of, you know, companies that the higher up you are in the food chain, you get kind of indemnified from any sort of messiness at the bottom.
Right. So you have deniability for horrible things that are happening to the people who are handling your products.
Yeah. It also becomes really, really difficult for your workforce to organize, if that's what they want to do. Because in some of these warehouses, you know, there's 6, 8, 12 different, agencies working in there, you know, a completely splintered workforce.
So you can't organize a union.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically.
Amazing. Now you tell some stories about this that I thought were just absolutely incredible. Actually, there was, and it's not just Walmart. There was at Hershey Products, for example. There was a kind of a wildcat walkout.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Walmart gets beat up on this kind of stuff because, you know, they're the top dog. But it's in a lot of companies and a lot of industries now. I mean, the Hershey thing over the summer. You know, these workers, they were kids from Eastern Europe and Asia who were here on guest worker visas. You know, this is a State Department program. And they staged a mass walkout over what they said were these horrible working conditions at a packing plant in Pennsylvania. You know, they said they were working all day lifting 50-pound boxes. They were told if they couldn't do it, they're going to be deported and this and that. And once all this came out, you had all this finger pointing among these different companies. You know, Hershey's saying, well, they don't work for us, you know, which they don't. They point to the company they contracted to, which in turn pointed to the temp agency that they contracted to.
Right.
So we're seeing this in different agencies. I mean, as far as the temping goes, you know, we've seen kind of outsourcing even in the hotel industry where, you know, the housekeeper who makes up your bed when you stay at a Hyatt doesn't necessarily work for Hyatt anymore.
Amazing. So would it be fair to say that what we're looking at is a fundamental transformation of the traditional American workplace?
I really think this is a piece of that. You know, and I've talked to plenty of folks who think we're only going to see more of this. You know, when it comes to outsourcing, we tend to think of jobs going overseas, you know, going to, you know, call center jobs going to India and whatnot. But really, this is a much more, you know, under the radar sort of domestic outsourcing where we have, you know, corporations sort of moving the employer responsibilities around to other players.
Right.
And as I said, there's a lot of advantages to it. And I think in a lot of ways, certainly for these people who work in these industries, it totally transforms their jobs.
For the worse.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of cases, you know, because the thing is, you know, as these contracts get passed down the line, you know, basically all these corporate middlemen are taking their own bite out of the pie. And so by the time you get down to the workers, you know, their wages, it might be tracking the minimum wage.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this is important in the warehouse industry because, you know, 20, 30 years ago, a lot of these they were overwhelmingly direct hire jobs. A lot of them were union jobs.
And they were good jobs.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
One of my friends growing up as a kid, his dad worked in a warehouse. I mean, in Lansing, Michigan. I mean, they were warehousing stuff for the automotive industry, but he had a union job. He was making 20, 30 bucks an hour, whatever it was back then, and had pension and healthcare.
Yeah, old timers will tell you that in the 70s and 80s, they were making nominally what a lot of these workers are making now. You know, some of these workers are making even less, you know.
Yeah.
Talk to a lot of folks who are getting $8.25, or you know, lately a lot of these workers have been getting paid by piece rate, which is, you know, you're paid by the container rather than the hour. So you're getting paid by this confusing formula that you don't even understand. And, you know, there have been lawsuits with these workers saying, hey, at the end of the day, we're not even making minimum wage here.
That's incredible. Contractors springing up to serve entire industries? Like, for example, I'm in the radio business. You know, we've got a call screener, we've got a board operator, we've got a guy running actually our video equipment. So could there be, to use this industry as an example, it's not big enough probably to support it, but could there be somebody who would go in the business of saying, okay, we'll provide board ops to, you know, 10 different radio shows, we'll provide call screeners, or is it more that they're just doing it for individual companies? You know, they're creating one for Hershey's, they're creating one for Walmart as a way to create that chain of deniability and screw the worker.
Yeah, I mean, how much of these companies spring up sort of at the behest of higher up corporations is really hard to know. But definitely, you know, they're known as staffing agencies. They don't like the word temp, but that's essentially what they are. They're temping sometimes in perpetuity. But you know, you see this in different industries. The amusing thing is I always see that there's often the name solutions is in the company name.
Right. And the solution is we're going to solve the employer's problem of things like healthcare benefits and pensions and unions. Right.
Yeah, the implication is we're going to solve problems for you, the company.
Right.
And so they're, you know, the hospitality industry, you'll find these agencies operating in pretty much every major city now. And, you know, where these major nexuses of warehouses, you're going to see so many temp agencies that it's hard to even keep track of them.
It's the third worldization of the United States, in my opinion. Dave Jamieson, HuffPo labor reporter over at HuffingtonPost.com. Thank you, Dave.
My pleasure, Tom.
Good talking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That is some brilliant reporting and a sad commentary on the state of America. It's like profits over all. To hell with the worker. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and let's see, Marty in Washington, New Jersey, listening on XM Radio. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hello, this is your resident atheist calling.
Okay.
I talked to you before.
How do I wish you a holiday greeting? Happy cynicism? Happy Festivus.
People say Merry Christmas to me. I say okay. Happy Winter Solstice.
Well, happy Winter Solstice, then.
Yeah, thank
okay.
you. It's just that I have my own business, and I'm paying more taxes than ExxonMobil, and I'm paying more property taxes than the local churches.
Right.
Yeah, it makes me mad. I have to work so much harder to pay for whatever they're not paying.
Yeah, I don't disagree at all. And this is why I say, you know, even as I consider myself, I'm not an atheist, and I'll just say that right up front. And although I have respect for atheism, especially for atheists with integrity, and which is most of them. But I don't think that churches outside of those who have no means, I mean, there are religions, you know, Christianity, Buddhism in particular, where monasticism is, you know, a part of their religion, living a vow of poverty and having no income and having no means to produce income. And I think that we all should respect that in some way and say those people shouldn't have to pay property taxes. But that's a very small slice. That's,
no, I understand. It's true. I was listening to WBAI, our local very good radio station, with Amy Goodman's on there.
Yeah.
And the Occupy New York tried to take over, I think it was called Trinity Church.
Trinity Church, yes.
Yeah, and they own literally, according to them, millions, if not billions of dollars.
Worth of real estate, yes.
In real estate.
Yes.
And they don't pay a penny in property tax.
That's right.
And it's maddening.
Yes.
It's maddening. And for me, I know that you believe. I don't believe. So how can, you know, people, just because they have a faith in some creature up in the sky, get money?
Right.
Or not have to pay money. So
yeah, I don't think they should. I don't think that there should be faith-based initiatives. I don't think the government should be handing money off to people who are running religious organizations. And I don't think that religious organizations outside of monastic, and frankly, I would say monastic, even secular organizations. I mean,
right.
You know, if for example, the movement of be here now. There's a phrase for it of it's a kind of a secular variation on Buddhism. Of just being present, you know, of conscious awareness or whatever.
I'm not sure because I just don't believe any of that.
You know, these people have, you know, like retreats and things,
do that.
Yeah, I, you know,
that, don't make me pay for your beliefs through property taxes, through higher taxes, through me having to work harder and take away time from my family.
I'm with you, Marty. I'm with you. Thank you for the call and thanks for saying it. Appreciate it. And happy festivals. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Yeah, I want to turn it back on the Republicans. And,
okay.
You know, with their talking points.
Yes, sir.
This is no time to raise taxes of the on-the-job producers.
Right, that's the Republican talking point. And what they miss is that the real job producers are the people who are spending money, which is, in this case, people getting unemployment checks.
No, I mean the workers.
That's what my point.
The workers.
Yeah, the workers,
yeah.
Too. No time to raise taxes on the workers, no time to cut unemployment benefits to those people who are getting them, because what it'll do is it'll drop GDP by a point or two. It'll throw us back into the Bush Great Depression, which we're not anything close to out of yet. And, you know, excellent point, Corky. And that's a point that the Democrats should be grabbing hold of, that the real job creators are the people who work for a living because they build things. They make things. They're the producers in our society. They're the real job creators and the people who spend money, even if they happen to spend money because they're on unemployment, because they're looking for work, but they're unemployed. And, you know, we don't want to be doing away with them. Ronald in La Plata, Maryland, is it? Ronald?
Yes.
Hey, what's up?
La Plata.
La Plata. Okay.
I wanted to talk about the church here, and you say they pay no taxes. But I'd also like to point out is that the benefits they get from the local, county, state, and federal government, it comes to millions of dollars. Do you have any idea how much?
I don't. In fact, I spent yesterday, Louise and me and Sam, who works on our TV show, spent collectively probably, and maybe Sean was on this, spent probably 2 hours, you know, frantically Googling all over the place, because we did this debate last night as well, trying to find a summary of what the total income and what the total assets of churches are in the United States. And you can't find those numbers. They're just not out there. $1.6 trillion is the amount of secular nonprofit organizations in the United States, the total assets. But you can't find for religious.
Yeah, they won't tell you about the church, even the Vatican. You don't even know how much they have.
No, although it's trillions.
But I'd like to point out, just living here locally, I can tell you a number of things that benefits that they get. For instance, if they're paving a road and they come by a church, they'll pay partially up the driveway. They don't do that in other residences. There's children here go to Catholic school that ride public buses. That's illegal. The President of the United States ought to be prosecuted for violating the Constitution. He just provided $15 million to the National Cathedral for repair as a result of the earthquake.
Right. Well, the National Cathedral, I think, is probably the one exception in as much as you could say that's, you know, sort of a tourist trap landmark, part of the, you know, Smithsonian, you know, hoop-de-doop stuff. And they're, you know, I don't have a problem with the National Cathedral, frankly, but because I think of
tourist traps.
Say that again.
And we're providing $15 million.
Yeah.
You know, there's people out there that have to abandon their homes for crying out because of the banks.
I know.
I mean, I don't hear them talking about providing them any money. That's a horrible thing to lose your home.
I agree.
That's horrible.
And the total amount of money, it's 1.6 or 1.7. No, I shouldn't quote this number from memory because I may have it wrong. But what I do know is that if you took half the money that the banksters, half of that $156 billion that the banksters are going to take and pay in bonuses this year, 50% of that, you could make whole basically all the underwater homeowners in America. And it's incredible what isn't being done and should be done. And at the same time, as you point out, Ronald, we're giving tax breaks to churches.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And it just struck me, the timing of this. Here we are at the holiday season, and I'm playing the Grinch. Anyhow, we've got the bad and the ugly up next. Yep, it's the good, the bad, and the very, very cornificially ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. The good, Senator Bob Cardin. As Republicans around the nation work to restrict voting rights, Senator Cardin is working to expand voting rights. The Democratic senator from Maryland introduced legislation to restore voting rights to individuals convicted of a felony after they've completed their prison sentences. Currently, 11 states in the country permanently bar felons from ever voting again, even after they've served their time. And it disproportionately affects minority voters who tend to vote for Democrats. Of the more than 2 million felons who've served their time but can't vote in America, 70% are black. Senator Cardin said this about his bill. When prisoners are released, they are rehabilitated and reintegrated into their community. With these responsibilities and obligations of citizenship should also come the right of citizenship, including the right to vote. He's right. Let's hope this bill gets some attention. The bad. Rick, don't Google my name, Santorum. Now that the issue of wealth inequality is at the forefront of the public debate, Rick Santorum let everyone know where he stands. While campaigning in Iowa, Santorum said, "Hey, talk about income inequality. I'm for income inequality. I think some people should make more than other people." We are one of the most unequal nations in the entire world. We're even more unequal than nations like Pakistan and the Ivory Coast. But Rick Santorum thinks that's just fine. Looks like we found another shill for the 1%. And the very, very ugly Ubisoft. The video game developer is releasing its latest installment of its Rainbow Six gaming franchise called Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six Patriots. It's based on the trailer, it looks like the game developers have made the new enemy, you and me, the 99%. In the game, a group of armed men raid a corporate board office and repeat many of the same messages of the 99% movement, saying, "This all started when you became bigger than the governments. That's how the land of the free became the kingdom of the few. It's time for a new balance of power." The armed men then murder the CEO. Conservative blogs are throwing their support behind the game's violent depiction of the 99% movement, with the Media Research Center writing, "The bad guys are basically Occupy Wall Streeters on steroids." Or, considering all the rioting, attacks against police and pyrotechnics coming from the occupiers lately, just a better organized next step for the more violent members of the 99%. All right. Thanks to Ubisoft, Fox so-called news viewers can validate their worst fears about Occupy Wall Street, even if those fears just exist in a video game. And that's very, very, very ugly. 866-97-TOM, THOM, our telephone number, Peter in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Hey, Tom. What you need to know is that we're fixing to lose our collective bargaining rights because of this deception of the people not going to, in the House and the Senate, not going to recess. Because of that, the president won't be allowed to use his right to appoint people to the board.
The National Labor Relations Board. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, which right now doesn't have enough members to function. And what I'm hearing, if you know, I hope this is good news, Peter. What I'm hearing is that at the very end of the year, there is the House and Senate have to be gaveled out of session, and then they can be gaveled back into session, and the whole process can take less than a second, but it has to happen. And Teddy Roosevelt did numerous recess appointments under those circumstances. And who's the guy that this president was quoting in his speech a few weeks ago? Teddy Roosevelt. I you know, if he's been reading his history books, he should know that he has the ability to not only appoint enough people to the National Labor Relations Board that it can be functional, but also to appoint the Elizabeth Warren's protege to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And there's a whole bunch of federal judges, and there's a bunch of other positions that are just, you know, waiting to be filled and haven't been because the Republicans have been filibustering all these appointments. And so I am very hopeful, Peter, that he will pull this thing off by the end of the year. I will be astounded, frankly, come January 2nd if he hasn't done that. So is that good news?
Yeah, I just thought there needed to be a mention of this because it sounded catastrophic.
Yeah, no, I'm absolutely with you. And in fact, the person who informed me about this was Victoria Jones in our newscast yesterday. She said that she was at the White House, and she'd been talking to people in the White House, and she said this is the buzz in the White House, is that the president's going to do this, and the Republicans are pretty much resigned to it because Teddy Roosevelt did it so many times, and he was a Republican, that there's so much precedent for it that about the only way they could stop it is to try and go to the Supreme Court or something, and they're not going to try and do that. So we'll see. We'll see. But it's, hopefully this will happen. Peter, thank you for the call. Floyd in Butler, Tennessee. Hey, Floyd, what's on your mind?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Floyd.
I used to race cars on Woodward Avenue at Ted's. I raced the first Corvette.
In Detroit.
In 55.
In Detroit, on Woodward Avenue?
I raced it.
I used to drive down Woodward Avenue in Detroit.
Well, I raced the first Corvette that ever run up the road.
Amazing.
I'm a concrete man, been one since 54, worked hard all my life. Yep. I'm a veteran of Vietnam. I've been in the Bay of Pigs. I've been down the road. You understand?
I do.
I left the world in 78, and I moved to Tennessee to where the poor people live because I'm satisfied. Period.
Yep.
That's the end of that question. But I am a card-carrying Republican.
Okay.
I've got the card in my pocket, and I tell these guys every day, and they talk Republican, I put that card in their face, and I want to see it. And they don't show it.
Yeah.
I am. I used to be. But I believe somewhere in you baby boomers have lost it.
Yeah.
I don't know where it happened, but it did.
It happened in 81 with the Reagan Revolution.
In 73, we lost our country. And I'm telling you, that's exact truth, and I talked about it then.
Yeah.
But these Republicans out there today, they need to wake up to what's happening to their economy. I was taught by my daddy, you give a man a good day's work, and he will give it back to you in pay.
Yeah.
But that is gone, too.
Yep.
Everything is gone. I just don't know what to do about it, and there ain't nothing. I'm 70 years old now.
Floyd, you are...
It's all done.
You are the kind of Republican my dad was, and that's... That's what we need in the Republican Party. We need, you know, people of integrity who hold the values, the traditional values of the Eisenhower Republican Party. And you know, my dad described himself as an Eisenhower Republican. And it's just such a tragedy that has been lost. Floyd, thank you for calling and sharing your story with us. And may I encourage you to encourage your Republican friends who share your values to take back the Republican Party, please?
You amaze me. As a baby boomer, you're the most amazing man I know.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate the compliment, Floyd, but it's really important. You know, I'm constantly calling on my liberal friends and progressive friends and, you know, whatever, you know, young people, old hippies, whatever, to take
you
back the Democratic Party.
With them.
Yeah, but you need to be, y'all Republicans, and there are Republicans of all ages and all stripes, need to be taking back the Republican Party, and then we can have an intelligent discourse in this country, because frankly, the corporations have taken over the Republican Party and the crazies, and to a large extent, or to some extent, a measurable extent, the Democratic Party's been taken over by the corporations too. Floyd, thank you for the call. It's so good to hear from you. And in your honor, I want to share with you a speech, a little fragment of a speech. It's just 30 seconds here, of Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican president, one of, in my opinion, one of the best presidents of the 20th century, a president who came into office on the platform in 1952 when he ran for president. His campaign ads, and we've played those before, I'm not going to play that right now, but his campaign ads said, vote for Eisenhower, vote for peace. He came into office on the platform of ending the Korean War, which he did, and he presided over 8 years of relative peace in the United States. And that was back in the days when presidents did that. Jimmy Carter was the last president to not have a war on his watch. And Dwight Eisenhower, a good, solid Republican, had this to say to the National Association of Newspaper Editors, if my recollection serves me right, in 1954. Does it say, Jacob, on the clip? It doesn't. I'm pretty sure it was 54. Might have been 53. It was while he was president of the United States. And here he is defining what it costs American society to have a hyperactive military-industrial complex. Here's Dwight Eisenhower.
A burden of arms, draining the wealth and labor of all people, a wasting of strength that defies the American system or the Soviet system or any system to achieve true abundance and happiness for the peoples of this earth. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this, a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with a 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is, I repeat, the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
Dwight Eisenhower, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That was back when Republicans were Republicans and Democrats were Democrats, and you could have an honest debate and people knew where people stood. Tell him, Leonard Cohen. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Bob in Portland. Hey, Bob. Thanks for listening to KPOJ. What's on your mind?
Bob? Is this Tom?
Yes, yeah, and you're on the air. What's up?
Thank you, sir. I've been talking with a conservative friend, and I've had some success, and I just very quickly like to share six easy points on how to talk with a friend that's a Republican and have success.
Okay.
The first point, it's, think of planting seeds that will grow in the mind. Number right. two, be patient.
Yep.
Don't expect them to grab everything all in one conversation.
Yep.
Don't try to win in one conversation.
Yep.
Remember that their emotions are involved. This is more emotional to them than fact.
Sure, and it is for everybody, actually. Our politics are formed in the part of our brain that controls, that regulates emotion more than the part that is logical.
Right. Another point here is that people will think about what you said for days after you say it. So don't think if they reject your idea the first time you talk to them that it's over in their mind. It's not.
Yep.
But also you need to end a conversation with a smile because, see, there's another emotional memory.
And it's an acknowledgement of your common humanity.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's how I've made progress with my friend. I haven't completely won him over yet.
Yeah.
But what's amazing is once he relaxes, we find out that we actually have things in common. Like, for example, he's a diehard Republican, but he wants to get money out of
Politics.
A political.
Yeah. Yeah, and those are the things. You look for those areas of commonality, and they are almost always there. And then you're kind of building your relationship and your friendship outside of politics, and eventually, I don't want to turn this into an evangelism 101 course, because I think that it's an appropriate and reasonable thing in America to have an argument, from the other side, to have people on the other side who actually, believe the things that conservatives and Republicans believe, and to have that debate. We've historically had that debate, and some of it, I think, is a legitimate debate. I mean, the core debate, I read about this in my book, Screwed, that the original debate between conservatives and liberals began arguably with Thomas Hobbes' book, Leviathan, in 1634, when he said he laid out for the very first time the conservative argument and the liberal argument. The conservative argument that he laid out was that everybody is basically evil, and therefore you have to have institutions and hierarchies to control people, which I disagree with, but conservatives do agree with. And he said, without the iron fist of church or state, then life would be nasty, brutish, and short, the way that life was before modern society in his mind. And then he also laid out the first liberal argument, and keep in mind, 1634 was a time when the king or the church, depending on what part of Europe you were living in, owned everything, right down to your underwear, was that people could govern themselves, that they didn't have to be governed by, existential power by virtue of birth in the case of kingdom, or by virtue of God's ordination in the case of the church. And so, these two concepts then grew into the Enlightenment and grew into the modern debate between conservatives and liberals. And I think that discussion about how do we govern ourselves and are we essentially good and how do we regulate society to keep out the sociopaths and all those other things that are the real core arguments between conservatives and liberals. All this other stuff is on the surface, but that's the stuff underneath. I think it's important to maintain that, to keep that going. So, Bob, good on you. That's a great list. And I congratulations. That's wonderful. Very well said. Tony in Leicester, Massachusetts. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you. I've listened to you for years, including KPOJ America, Air America, and stuff like that.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for your service to the American people. My question is, what do you say to people who do not oppose drug testing or may be otherwise involved in it somehow? I feel there should be a standard convincing argument against drug testing that should be set in the public mind, sort of like a meme.
Yeah.
The working class can say to each other to sort of spread the word that this is a bad idea.
Well, the simple one is punish the destructive behavior, not the substance or not the user. In other words, if somebody has a half a beer or one beer, that shouldn't disqualify them from being able to participate to drive, for that matter. I mean, you're under the legal limit, right? And so you want to punish people for being intoxicated, whether it's with pot or whether it's with alcohol. And so, and do we really want to have, and then the second argument that I would make, and I think this is probably a stronger argument, although there's very few people alive today who remember Prohibition, but they certainly remember the stories from Prohibition, how Al Capone and all this stuff and all this, our cities were war zones. Chicago was a war zone, and people would drive along with submachine guns. It was like, the border with Mexico is, because alcohol was illegal, and so it became an illegal drug. And so the question is, do we really want to have this war on drugs? Do we really want to be spending billions of dollars? Do we really want to have more prisoners in our prison than any other country on earth, and half of them are there for drug offenses? Do we really want to spend so much of our national treasure? Do we really want to destroy the lives of so many of our young people by our legal system in this insane war on drugs? And, use the arguments that basically Ron Paul and the libertarians are using. They're absolutely, they're right on these issues. on the drug war. It's time to end the Nixon's war on drugs. It was Richard Nixon who declared the war on drugs, and it's been incredibly profitable for the drug testing industry, for the private prison industry, and for the police services industry, as it were. And these are not industries that we should be encouraging, frankly, in my opinion. Tony, thanks for the call. I hope that's helpful. I hope that's helpful. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to have a special edition of Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders will be here taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate, when you get active. Get out there and occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.